This is side two of the Frank Dennis tape. When the tape ended, we were talking about President Hanna and when Dr. Dennis came to campus and some of the presidents that you worked with. Walter Adams, did you have any contact with him you first got here?
No personal contact with him. I remember his statement about SDS, his Students for Democratic Society, has snatched victory out of the jaws of, has snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory. I always remember that as classic Adams. Cigar, but I didn't have any personal contact.
Mm-hmm. How about President Wharton?
I talked with him briefly once, but he wouldn't have known me.
Oh, okay.
I liked Wharton. I thought he was a very good person. I remember comments about, I think this was when he was head of TIA CREF in New York State, but he had all the information in his head. It was as if he didn't have to take any notes. He knew it was all there.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Had that ability. Yeah. In the 1970s, then, when you were doing mostly research, or was it?
Research teaching. I had a 50-50 mm-hmm. appointment. So I started out on a project on dormancy. And the reason for studying dormancy, this was the fruit trees, was of the damage done by frost, particularly in cherries mm-hmm. in Michigan. There has always been, since Michigan grew cherries, this problem of frost. There's less danger near the lakes because they have a warming effect. They keep the area cooler in the spring, actually, warmer in the late fall. So the trees don't develop as rapidly and there's less danger of frost. Temperatures don't fluctuate as much. So I tried to find some way of delaying bloom. If we could delay bloom, then you might avoid frost. In Utah at the time, they had developed a system of evaporative cooling. So they irrigated the trees, sprinklers, with what's really mist.
Mm-hmm.
And this, they could delay bloom there in Utah several weeks, up to maybe three, even 4 weeks maybe.
Just by spraying water?
By spraying water, the evaporative cooling, they don't have much rain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dry climate. So by sprinkling the trees, whenever the temperature went above X, the water evaporates, that causes the heat to be taken from the buds.
Mm-hmm.
And that delayed the bloom.
Delayed it, oh, okay.
I tried it here in a number of orchards and grapes, cherries, and various other things. But here we have, first of all, we have a more humid climate, so there's not as much evaporation. Evaporation is not as rapid.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we have more rainy days, more cloudy days, etc. So I never got more than a few days delay in bloom. It was very disappointing, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem was that I was running these experiments 30, 40 miles away, mm-hmm. so it was a little difficult to keep track of them, control them. But that wasn't very successful. I also tried some chemicals that were reported to delay bloom. None of them was effective without causing injury.
Mm-hmm.
For example, gibberellins had been reported to delay bloom when applied in the spring, in the fall. They delayed bloom the following year. Well,
mm-hmm.
I sprayed some apricots with gibberellins one fall and delayed bloom forever.
Did it kill the trees?
Well, it didn't kill the trees, but it killed some of the main limbs, so there were just sprouts on them. And so I decided that wasn't going to work. There's another chemical caused a lot of, peaches caused gamosis. This is ethaphon. There are reports, in fact, that this is effective. Ethaphon is a chemical that breaks down and releases ethylene gas in the tissues. And this would delay bloom under the right conditions. But on peaches, if you use too much, you damage the trees, you get a lot of gamosis on these trees. So that didn't work out very well. None of these chemicals that delay bloom. One of them, however, that I tested had a marked effect on fruit set without apparent injury.
Mm-hmm.
So it increased fruit set. Now this chemical never got off the ground as a fruit set chemical, but it's now used as a delaying maturity in apples. It's called Retain, R-E capital T-A-I-N, commercial product. and that is effective. It's sprayed on several weeks before harvest. The apples are firmer, they will keep longer in storage, etc. So the chemical became a commercial product, but it wasn't useful for what I was interested in. I worked on a delicious fruit set project. There were growers in the state who were having problems getting good fruit set on delicious apple. So I did a cooperative project. I talked many people around the country, researchers, into keeping track of fruit set on delicious, keeping track of weather conditions. A bulletin was published in the late 20s, I guess it was, by V.R. Gardner and Associates. Gardner was the chairman of the horticulture department here. He had done a study like this, and their conclusion was that the temperatures prior to bloom had a marked effect on fruit set of delicious. That, as I remember, it was low temperatures, reduced fruit set. I analyzed his data and found they were non-significant. this was, you know, in the 20s, they weren't using much statistics, uh-huh, or any at the time. So I got these people to cooperate with me. We did a study on it, and sure enough, there wasn't much effect of temperature. But then, in the process, I kept records on fruit set in growers' orchards and found that there wasn't much of a problem on fruit set. They were getting reasonably good fruit set. Mm. And in fact, sometimes they were getting too much fruit set, so that required fruit thinning. Mm-hmm. So that took me into fruit thinning.
Okay.
So I tested a number of chemicals in addition. The old standby was naphthalene acetic acid, NAA. So I used that with other chemicals, including ethaphon, which reduces fruit set, and several chemicals that came out later. Excel, A-C-C-E-L, Excel was introduced. That has a mild thinning effect. It's better when used along with NAA. So these were all practical experiments in growers' orchards.
And some of these were commercially available?
Some of the chemicals. In fact, most of the chemicals that I used were commercially
ready.
Excel was new on the market, so I tested that. Mm-hmm. John Bukovac, meanwhile, was working on thinning from a more, I would say, theoretical standpoint. He did most of his work at the Clarksville Experiment Station, where he could harvest whole trees and get all of the data instead of partial data. So our results were shared, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And we were supported there by the Michigan Apple Committee, mm-hmm, Apple Research Committee.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do? So you did
These were all commercial trials in Belding, for example.
Okay.
There was an orchard in Belding on the ridge near Sparta, mm-hmm, southeast Michigan, southwest Michigan, hilltop orchards, mm-hmm, Dowd orchards. So they were all grower orchards.
Mm-hmm. So what degree did they look to Michigan State for that support?
They were very cooperative. That's why I emphasize the fact that fruit growers have been very cooperative in the use of their orchards. In one case, this was another chemical. It's LR. You've heard about LR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The LR scare created
scare.
Media.
Right. Well, LR had the same effect as this Retain. It was sprayed on 30 days before harvest.
Before harvest, okay.
And it firmed the fruit, and they would keep longer in storage. Mm-hmm. So in one test, we sprayed, we had rows that were sprayed and rows that were unsprayed. And we wanted to put them through a packing house to see what the results would be on pack out. Well, that year, the processing price was better than the pack-out price, the fresh market price.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So the growers said, well, we'd prefer to sell these for processing. But the company that made LR said, well, they'd make up the difference if there was a difference if we put them through a packing house. So we did, and they had to pay the difference. So the growers didn't suffer, but the company had to pay the crop.
Mm-hmm. Did you continue with the research just on apples, or did you?
Most of the work that I did was on apples. As I said, some of this some of the work on delaying bloom, much of that was done with peaches. I did peaches and cherries. Okay. One of the last projects I worked on was soft cherries. This has been kind of a difficult one to solve, but the sour cherries are machine harvested, sweet cherries are too, but the problem is mainly with sour cherries, mm-hmm. packed cherries.
Because they're softer, generally.
They're softer, generally.
When they're ripe?
When they're ripe. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, under certain conditions, they splatter on the canvas, essentially.
Or
they, not, maybe they don't splatter, but they're mm-hmm. so softened that they can't process them. They don't roll
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
when they take them into the processing plant. Mm-hmm. So this was an enigma wrapped in a mystery, so to speak. So we did some experiments, a graduate student, this was a graduate student project, did some experiments in various orchards. We used chemicals, we used shading, we thinned the fruit to see if there was any difference of fruit load. And then these cherries were processed and we took samples. Unfortunately, we selected orchards where the soft cherries had been a problem the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, none of these people had soft cherries
the following year.
So that screwed us up there. Mm-hmm. But then we worked with the ag engineers looking at some differences in, we started dropping cherries, just to drop them to various surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
Just one was just a canvas, one was a board, and various surfaces that might be used on catching frames. And there was a fairly marked difference in mm-hmm. the catching frame material, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
that they followed up on. But they're still working on this one, and the problem still isn't solved. And one of the problems is this variability,
mm-hmm.
to be able to predict when you're going to have soft cherries and when you're not going to mm-hmm. have soft cherries.
Do you think it's more weather-related, or was it something within it?
It may be weather-related, it may be nutrition-regulated. We looked at orchards in which they had used nitrogen or not nitrogen and mm-hmm. this kind of thing, but we just never were able to get a handle on it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Now, some recent work, they think they have a handle. We shall see. That remains a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked on some theoretical projects. Some of the first graduate students I worked with did their research on abscisic acid in relation to dormancy. Now, abscisic acid, A-B-S-C-I-S-I-C, is a compound that occurs naturally in plants, and it was early on, it's an inhibitor of growth when you have an artificial system that we were using, wheat coleoptile sections, this sort of thing, that inhibits growth, and it will inhibit growth of plants in some cases, but it's not very effective when sprayed on. But it was considered to be a prime candidate for controlling dormancy, so that there was some data that indicated that abscisic acid levels declined during the winter, during chilling. These abscisic acid levels declined, and then in the spring they were low enough so that growth would resume.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the students worked on peach seeds, on apple seeds, on cherry buds, and the bottom line was that it didn't, that these levels declined, but temperature didn't have any effect. And chilling breaks dormancy. If you take a peach tree in the fall, it won't grow unless it has been chilled,
mm-hmm.
a dormant tree.
Mm-hmm.
And cherries, peaches, apples, so on. So the temperature was having no effect, therefore it couldn't be related to dormancy.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, our results didn't favor the correlation with dormancy.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who was some of those graduate students?
Eugene Melke, M-I-E-L-K-E.
Okay.
Prince Bonamy, his name was Prince, he was from the Bahamas. Richard Balboa, his last name was Balboa, he was from Chile, Orlando Balboa.
Mm-hmm.
They all worked on these projects. Fairly recently, time I retired, we were working on a project to see what the relationship was between gibberellins and flowering in apple. Now, as I mentioned, gibberellin sprays. If you apply gibberellins to apple trees, cherry trees, whatever, at the right concentrations, they will inhibit flowering. And it's concentration dependent. So if you use a small concentration, you get a small inhibition. If you use high concentration, you get total inhibition of flowering. I mentioned that apple seeds contain gibberellins. And the hypothesis was that developing seeds, produce these gibberellins. They move to the bud where they inhibit flowering. So the idea was, could we measure these gibberellin levels and see if there really was a correlation? For example, if you defruited early enough, did it reduce the gibberellin concentration in the bud? Mm-hmm. Also, one student, Ban Jun, actually his first name is Jun, J-U-N-B-A-N. There were two students, Jun Ban, worked on metabolism of gibberellins. So what he did was to feed precursors of the gibberellins, radioactive precursors, to the seeds in situ on the tree, and then measure what happened to the radioactivity, if he could recover the radioactivity in the buds or anywhere else. Unfortunately, that gibberellin didn't move. There were problems involved. It's possible that the gibberellins were metabolized so rapidly when they're injected, they weren't natural gibberellins, that we just got artifacts. I think that's what happened, because we never could identify any of the metabolites, or he never could identify them. I had another student, John Nielsen, N-E-I-L-S-E-N, who was from Utah, who was working on endogenous levels. So that Jun Ban was working on metabolism, John was working on endogenous levels. So what he did was to take spurs that were bearing fruits and spurs that were not bearing fruits and measure gibberellins in those. But that was unfortunate. We could never get good results on that as far as identifying gibberellins and measuring their contents. Mm-hmm.
And this is a continuation, really, of your earlier work, right? Your postdoc?
Postdoc. In that case, I was just working on identification rather than correlation with anything. Mm-hmm. I spent a sabbatical leave in England, in Bristol, in the chemistry department, working with Jake McMillan, M-A-C, capital M-I-L-L-A-N. Jake was a gibberellin expert. This was in 1975. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of a double-barreled sabbatical, because another professor from Davis, George Martin, was there at the same time. We had agreed we'd do a double project. So we were working on pear seeds. He worked on immature pear seeds. I worked on mature pear seeds. And we measured gibberellin content. There were a number of gibberellins were identified, including a new one at that time. It was GA47. There are now over 100 of these known gibberellins. Mm. So he got good results with identification, quantification of these. On the dormant or the mature pear seeds, we were able to identify only one gibberellin, GA17, which is inactive. And it was rather discouraging working with those, because just
didn't do anything.
Yeah, we couldn't measure levels, and but anyway, identify one. So I had done that work in 75, but I hadn't done more work on endogenous gibberellins until this later work.
Mm-hmm. It seems like an interesting thread in your
career. I've always been interested in the gibberellins. I got interested in them in graduate school and remained interested in them.
Yeah. Some of your students were international students, and was that the case in horticulture?
Yes.
Any particular countries that were a lot of here at Michigan State that came to study horticulture?
There were quite a few from Italy, because we have had contacts with Italy. John Bukovac had some contacts there, so that several students, and Jim Flory now has had a number of students from Italy.
What crops were they interested in?
These were all tree fruits.
Tree fruits, okay.
Both John, We had some students in veg crops from Zimbabwe. Bob Herner spent it was more than a sabbatical. I think he spent a year and a half there on a USAID project to beef up their horticulture department. And so as a result of that contact, there were several students from Zimbabwe. Beginning in 1981, I think we had the first Chinese scholars here in horticulture. Two women came from China. At the time, they were not supposed to get degrees because that elevates you above the populace, so you don't get degrees. So they were here just to do research. Mm-hmm. But they realized, they and their people that sent them, realized at the time that it would be better to have them take courses and really get a PhD, master's, or whatever. But that was our first group from China. Of course, now we've had many students from China. Mm-hmm. So I had a student and various others. The interesting thing about it, I don't think any of those students have returned to China. There may be one or two. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you compare what their possibilities are and the possibilities in China, there's mm-hmm. no question.
Yeah.
I know that my student said that if he went back to China, he'd be at the end of the line in terms of promotion, that the people who had stayed there, even though they didn't have advanced degrees, mm-hmm. would be more in line for promotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the case.
Interesting. Yeah. What areas, were they in fruit culture also, or was it all areas?
The people I spoke of were in fruit, but they were in all areas.
Mm-hmm.
But less so in ornamentals.
Okay.
But they were in vegetable crops and tree fruits mm-hmm. primarily.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you find any effort of, like, you had an overseas experience as a beginning yep. professor? Did any of your students, did they do anything similar like that? Take overseas assignments or do overseas research?
Well, the one I spoke of, Gene Melke, did some short-term work in Mexico.
Okay.
In fact, I went there with him one time. I should mention in terms of international things, I was one of the organizers of a so-called working group on temperate zone fruits in the tropics and subtropics as a part of the International Horticultural Society. I went to a meeting in Hamburg. There was the International Society meets every 4 years. This meeting was in Hamburg in 1980, I forgot which one it was. But while there, I met a group of people, all of whom were interested in the production of temperate zone fruits in the tropics and subtropics, mm-hmm. so we formed this working group. The situation background on that is, as I mentioned, these temperate zone fruits cannot be grown in the tropics, with exceptions, because they don't have a chilling period.
Mm-hmm.
However, under certain circumstances, certain climatic conditions, they can be grown there. And for example, in Venezuela, they grow peaches. What they do is defoliate them after harvest. Within the next month or so, the leaves come out again, they can produce another crop, and they get two crops a year.
Hmm.
The same can be done with apples in certain areas, with grapes. Grapes, they were growing as many as three crops a year in Venezuela. They do this in India, southern part of India. So a number of areas have the right climatic conditions so that they can grow these fruits. So we had conferences, workshops in a number of countries. The first one was in Ethiopia at a time when the communist government was still in power there.
It was in the early 80s?
I think so. Probably 82 or so. 82. I'm not exactly sure of the date. And we had one in, I have to stop and think here. We had one in India, Turkey, several other countries.
And you went to almost all of them?
I went to almost all. I was, as I say, I was chair of this and printed a newsletter and that kind of thing, kept people in touch. And so that was a very interesting experience for me.
Mm-hmm. And so that work continued, or the crops are being grown?
Egypt was another. The Working group continues. When I retired, I retired from the working group. I guess I went to one more in Turkey. Mm-hmm. But that continues under different chairmanship. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've always been pleased that that was done. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make a big dent in terms of economics, but it does provide small farmers' income in these countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think in some of the materials that I looked at, you had been in Jamaica. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I took a sabbatical in Jamaica. I'd always been interested in developing countries. At one time, I thought about being an agricultural missionary, mm-hmm. but I decided that was too narrow approach. And so, as I say, I was interested in this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So for that sabbatical, I learned that they were in need of instructors at a college that had just been opened in Jamaica. University of the West Indies, Jamaica. Don Wilson, who got a PhD here in education, told me about this college that was opening up in Jamaica. So I took a 6-month leave of absence there, or not leave of absence, a sabbatical. The bottom line there was, it was very interesting but very frustrating. The story was that the Jamaica School of Agriculture, which had been in business for many years, I don't know just how many, and was near Kingston, had been closed down by the government. The government had been, Manley Miles, I can't remember his name, the Prime Minister had been a leftist, and there were leftists supposedly in the faculty of the Jamaica School of Agriculture. So the government, the conservative government, came into power and they decided they were going to close down the Jamaica School of Agriculture, which they did. And buildings had been built on the north coast with help of USAID. This was to be a secondary agricultural school. But the government decided, well, that's available, we'll use that for this college. So they moved the students over there with very few instructors. People were commuting from the Department of Education in Kingston over the hills there, but the students were very unhappy with the situation. So they struck, and making a long story short, which is difficult for me, they kicked them all out except for a few students who were not there. They were out on internships. Mm-hmm. So I taught these students who were out on internships. The others were new students. The dean was very dictatorial. He was a Jamaican. And the students didn't like that. And it was very poor atmosphere mm-hmm. there. I enjoyed being there. I learned a lot about tropical agriculture, and particularly ornamental horticulture. I was teaching ornamental horticulture, which I knew nothing about, so I had to stay one jump ahead of the students. I was interested in that. I had to memorize these Latin names. Well, they were better at it than I was. They were used to memorizing. But, as I say, it was mm-hmm. very interesting, but not very rewarding in that sense.
Did you learn in staying ahead of the students in the ornamental? When you came back here, did that help you a little bit?
Except that these were mainly tropical ornamental.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't do much good.
Woody plants.
In Michigan.
Poinsettia, is a subtropical mm-hmm. ornamental. Mm-hmm. So some of them are common plants, mm-hmm. but most of them are tropicals.
Yeah. What did you see in terms of the years that you were here, the international experience, both encouraging faculty and also students at that exchange, seemed to place Michigan State in an important area almost worldwide. You were a part of that in terms of the research that students, international students that you taught. Now, did you teach any study abroad? Were you taught MSU students there in a different location? Or
no?
Not that.
My wife was working in study abroad programs at one time. So I went with her to England one summer with a group of not international students, but study abroad students. Uh-huh. I spent my time in libraries collecting information for a paper I was writing.
Okay.
But I had some experience with that. Mm-hmm. I made a number of visits here and there. I went to to not approach. Forgotten my P's and Q's here. Ecuador.
Ecuador.
I went to Ecuador on a program. This was just with. In fact, I went to Costa Rica to a meeting and went to Ecuador, so on. This was money provided by the university to make contacts with people abroad in agriculture. In Ecuador, I met a person who was actually a Venezuelan, I remember, a Peruvian, and he was interested in naranjilla. Well, naranjilla in Spanish means little orange, but naranjilla is a solanaceous plant that is grown by natives mainly in Ecuador and Peru, and it has market potential, but not much was known about how to grow it. So we put our heads together and organized a conference which was supported by NSF on naranjilla. And we had some very good people there. One was a man from an American who lived in Mexico, but he'd worked for Campbell Soup Company with naranjilla because they were interested. They'd tried various combination fruit companies.